Welcome to Cisflix, the podcast where we won't judge you for talking through the movie. Cisflix are the movies you laugh at, yearn for, and overanalyze with your girls, significant others, and now us.
We are your hosts,
Paola
and Nadja, two sisters and designers who discuss chick flicks we hate to love,
tropes we love to hate,
and all of the aesthetic choices in between. Join us as we break down our favorite movies together. We're moving on to episode 7, titled Oceans Apart.
Episode 7, Oceans Apart, opens with an amazing sequence between Daphne and Simon. So they're in a fight, but they're showing you this through Daphne playing a very up-tempo Beethoven on her piano and Simon shooting birds. Mm-hmm. And it is so chaotic. I love how this sequence is put together to show you their conflict and how chaotic it feels in their home right now. And it's also showing you just their wills. Like, they're both strong-willed and they're both competing with each other at this point.
They're so fucking stubborn.
Who is going to give in first? Who is going to forgive first? That's what they're waiting for. They're waiting for the other to give. And we all know where that can lead. So, and this is the energy that continues quite literally almost through the rest of this episode. Mm-hmm. They're arguing again. And while they're arguing, they receive all the way in Cliveden, Lady Whistledown's society papers, mm-hmm. all the way from London. And they learn about Colin's scandal. Daphne immediately wants to pick up and leave. She's like, my family's going through something.
I need to be there.
And Simon's like, okay, I'm going to join you. She's like, no. This is my family matter. Your lying ass can stay right here. And he's like, no, I'll tolerate having separate bedrooms, but a separate household will not be suffered. I give credit to Simon because you start to get these signs. And I think you've gotten them throughout the series, is how determined he is to be the opposite of what his father was. And he does that by saying, no, I'm going to stick with my family. That may just be me and you, but we're going to stick together. We're going to do this shit together. I'm not playing that. Yo aquí, tú allá. No.
Yeah.
You see how each of the households are dealing with the scandal and the shun of the ton. This is the first glimpse you get of how unforgivable the rejection of the ton can be. Mm-hmm. Where Lady Featherington is being shunned and she's trying to find a woman's home for Marina. They won't open up their doors to them. People are asking her for money, even when she's going to places that are supposed to be charitable, because they see that they're of a higher society. Like, oh, you want to harbor your pregnant daughter here? Give us money. Mm-hmm. If not, kick rocks.
Yeah.
The Bridgertons, on the other hand, are counting on the popularity of Simon and Daphne to help them stay relevant in society and not be shunned, right? Because the ton, they're obsessed with position in society.
They're not going to shun a Duke and Duchess.
They want to be invited to the Duke and Duchess's home and the Duke and Duchess's ball. So if the Duke and Duchess is in your favor, then you're good. They're hoping to be able to make it until people forget, essentially.
Yeah.
The Duke and Duchess are their PR team. Daphne arrives at home, back at the Bridgerton house, back with mom. They're trying to plot what's the next event that they can all go to together to show that they're a unit. And Daphne just continues to take small opportunities to send like these little passive aggressive jabs in her mother's direction, mm-hmm. as she resents her for not educating her properly about sex. This is the root of the issue she's having with the Duke, is her naiveness and not understanding how sex worked and how making babies worked.
Because if she had known, she would have been able to call him out sooner.
Exactly. Her anger and her disappointment shows in her clothes and hair and makeup. Like, she starts to shift into darker blues and darker teals. She's no longer rocking the little baby bangs. Like, she's starting to let out longer wisps of her hair on the side.
And part of that, too, is, like, this loss of innocence. Like, she's married.
Loss of innocence, yes. Her maturing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure. Exactly. Later that afternoon, one of the events that they're going to attend together is the Queen's Luncheon. This is the first event that the Hastings attend with the Bridgertons to distract from Colin's situation. And it works. everyone's congratulating them. Everyone's coming up to them. How have you guys been? How was the honeymoon? And they're back to their ruse days, because now they have to continue to play that everything's fine and well and they're crazy in love.
Yeah.
And everything works until the Featheringtons try to show up to this luncheon playing the victim, because Lady Featherington is playing as though she was also betrayed by Marina. She's also a victim of Marina's secret.
She's like, oh my God, how would I have known? It's so crazy.
Oh my God. Lady Bridgerton, can you believe we were both betrayed by this hussy?
And Lady Bridgerton is like, bitch, I will get fucking you thrown cut you. Out. What you tried to have done to my son.
Seriously. And she quite literally just turns around, walks away. Mm-hmm. And Brimsley comes and asks them to leave. They are kicked out of the luncheon.
Because I think... it's not that she has a reputation for this, but I think everybody knows that Lady Featherington is kind of a schemer. Like, mm-hmm. I think the subtext is that no one puts it past her that she right. would have known about the pregnancy and just tried to move it, keep it
your
moving.
Your mom. You've had babies. You know what yeah. this shit is. This woman's been at your house. You know she hasn't had her period.
She's been at your house for 2 months. You know.
Yeah.
Because, again, the same way that Lady Featherington initially found out, Marina was there. She was there for over a month and did not get her period. And the servant was like, ah, hey, I just thought you should fucking know. This unmarried girl living at your house for the summer or for the spring has not gotten her fucking period. Anyway, cool. Bye. I'm out.
And something that's noted later on is that Lady Whistledown didn't make one mention of the Queen's luncheon in her society papers that week. And this makes the queen tight. She is so
pissed.
Upset. She's pissed. She feels slighted by Lady Whistledown by not mentioning her luncheon at all. With all of this shit going on, Daphne promises Colin that she will chaperone a secret meeting between him and Marina.
Bold.
So she's like, you know, I'm here to be a peacemaker. I'm going to try to help you out as much as I can. Because Colin doesn't believe what Lady Whistledown wrote about Marina. He doesn't believe. He thinks it's a lie. There's no way she was going to betray me like that.
Wee. Sweetie, do I have news for you?
Marina confirmed that it was all true. And she confesses that she felt she had no choice and that she wasn't properly guided to seek a different resolution. And that's true.
It's true. The resolution was always going to be to con a man.
No. But she was resistant to that.
Yeah.
She was pushed to do that by Lady Featherington. So True. This woman who she was put under her protection sold it to her that this was her only option.
And she believed her. I mean, in fairness to Lady Featherington, it kind of was.
She even made her believe that her man that she was waiting around for did not love her and did not want anything to do with her and her child.
That part, that's shitty. Fault Featherington for.
Exactly. Well, naturally, Colin feels taken advantage of. He feels like he's been played a fool. And he even says that the saddest part about the whole ordeal is that had she gone to him in earnest and told him about her situation, that he would have offered to marry her and raise the child together as his own.
In fairness to her, how the fuck would she have known that?
How does she know that any mention of that, you wouldn't go and absolutely ruin her?
Lose your shit, first of all.
Exactly.
And then tell fucking everyone.
Right. And then get her officially shunned and kicked out of society.
Yep.
Daphne, she's chaperoning this visit and she overhears this exchange between them. And I think that she ends up finding some parallels to her own situation.
Daphne sees a lot of parallels between her situation and Colin's, because Colin was also ignorant of Marina's situation and put into a situation unwittingly where he would have been forced to act as the father of a child that was not biologically his. And Daphne was made ignorant and put into a situation where she would have had to give up her dream of having a family and her own children because the Duke was withholding why he wasn't able to have children. Daphne reaches out to Marina. I mean, she is feeling hard for this girl and is promising to help her. She's like, listen, I'll try to find George. Why should he be the one to choose your future? He should be the one held responsible for what's happening with you. And Marina has no hope. I mean, she is dejected. Like, you're really feeling for Marina at this point. And all of that said, she's still a brat. So Daphne receives an invitation while she's in London to Lady Danbury's soiree, which is specifically for like married women of the ton to go and act goddamn fools at Lady Danbury's house.
This looks a lot more fun than any other ball.
This looks ever. The most fun. And Daphne, she's still very naive. She's still very sheltered. Like, there are so many things that she doesn't know. And so she goes to this soiree and realizes it's like a game night where all of the married ladies are gambling, drinking, again, acting fools. And she's like, wow, this is so different from what I was expecting. And Lady Danbury's like smoking a pipe. Like, she's so fucking cool. I love Lady Danbury. And Daphne asks to sit at the same table as the wife of one of the generals in the military, in the army or militia, whatever it's called. She wants to use her influence as a duchess to get information from this general so that she can inquire after George Crane. Like, he's got a girl in some trouble, okay? Like, we need to sort this out. She ends up becoming friends with some other married ladies of the ton as she's like gambling and drinking, and she has like a pathway for communication between herself and this general. What she also learns is how many other married women in society don't like or get along with their husbands, how they prefer to live separately from them rather than how Daphne feels, which is how they're arbitrarily separate from each other, but they want to be together.
Well, because that's also how she saw her mother and father be.
Exactly.
Always together, always
very much in a loving
relationship.
And so she's like, my parents were madly in love, and that's why I wanted a relationship where I was madly in love, and that's why it feels like my life is kind of falling apart right now. Meanwhile, the other women are like, yeah, whatever. My husband died anyway. And it's like, ah, what? Like, they're so cavalier because it's understood that the vast majority of marriages, and this is true, like, historically, the vast majority of marriages in that era were fucking business propositions. Like, truly, you're combining wealth or acquiring wealth, combining land or acquiring land, and acquiring power. There wasn't like a sentimentality to it. Human beings have had feelings for as long as we've been human beings, but like, you were expected, especially as a woman, you were expected to just put a cap on your feelings and just deal with shit. Be miserable, but be miserable in a nice house rather than miserable and in love in a little shack in the bad side of London. So we see Simon and Anthony run into each other at the Gentlemen's Club. White's Gentlemen's Club. Not a strip club. Not yet.
Not yet. That's later.
That's later. That's later in the night. This after a few more drinks. And Anthony, he just sucks so much in season one. You can tell that so much of his behavior is put on. So much of it is affectation. He feels like he has to behave a certain way, has to be a certain kind of person. I'm a gentleman. I'm a Viscount. I'm this, I'm that. And it's like, no, you're 28 years old. You're nervous and afraid of things, and you suck.
Calm the fuck down.
Exactly. Like, your unwillingness to admit this to yourself even, or to anybody, is why no one fucking likes you right now. It's why you're not getting along with your siblings. It's why you're constantly at odds with your mom. Antony starts trying to be like chummy and bro-y with the Duke. The Duke is clearly in a horrible fucking mood, and he's just kind of like, Antony, what the fuck do you want? Like, I don't want to talk to you, okay? And Antony's like, cool, you really fucked something up with my sister. I can tell that there's something wrong, and you're gonna fucking fix it. Simon is kind of like, listen, dude, I never said I wasn't gonna fix it. She's my wife. I'm in charge of her care. I'm gonna make sure that she has a good life. You need to keep your eyes on your own motherfucking paper, because you're failing this test, my dude. It's like sharp, like they are pissed. Anthony, this is his favorite thing to do in season one, and it gets annoying fast. And we're in episode 7 already, okay? He's like, listen, you don't know what it's like to run a family because you don't have one, and that's not my fault. And the Duke is like, oh.
You mean the family that you're failing to run properly?
You mean the family you're running into the goddamn ground? Oh, is that how you run a family? Because I doubt that's how your father did it. As soon as Simon is like, oh, would your father be proud of you? That's when Anthony loses it. This man lunges across the table. They get into a fucking fist fight, leaving Simon. He cuts up his lip and his eye.
Throwing bows.
They get pulled apart. I think both of them get ushered out of the club. Simon heads home. Once he's home, Daphne comes across him in his own quarters, right? Because they're not sharing a room anymore. She's like, let me tend to your wounds. And a fun thing, I know why they do this in movies. It's because they have lots of fancy special effects makeup that you don't want to disrupt by wiping it off every take. And for continuity's sake, but I always hate watching people tend to wounds in TV shows because I'm like, the way no one on earth has ever touched a wound like that. Anyway, that's a qualm that's never going to go away. So she's like, let me tend to your wound by rubbing this wet handkerchief along the perimeter of your cut.
And or else it'll take the makeup off.
Or else I'll just wipe all this hard work off. And if we have to do this take again, we'll all be mad. They have this intimate moment because she's so close to him.
It's a sweet moment.
They like each other so much.
They like each other so much.
It makes it so much more annoying.
They're drawn each other in a way like they can't be near each other without
being near each other.
Yeah, for sure. Ugh.
And she kind of is like, can you just fucking tell me what is going on? This is so stupid. And he's like, listen, I made this very important vow to my dead father.
On his deathbed, Naja. It makes it a lot more.
I made this very serious. Important vow to my super dead father as he died about how I wasn't going to have any kids. And then guess what? He had a heart attack and died. Anyway, I need to keep this vow because my father's worth it. What? Like, no, he's not. But the other thing is, it's like I'm watching this as a person who is like currently electing to not have a child in this time in my life. And like, I do resent the narrative that Daphne is pushing, that a life is only worthwhile if you have children in it.
Mm-hmm. 100%. Well, and that's been pushed onto her.
Yes. Yeah. It's been pushed onto her. She has a big family. It's of the time. Everybody has to have heirs. I get that from a logistical standpoint, but I just resent that if you're childless, you're automatically unhappy and miserable. So he's describing this dumb fuck vow to her. She reminds him like, yo, you made a vow to me. Like, we fucking got married. You vowed to me that you were going to be like honest and true and take care of me and all that jazz.
How about this vow to the living person that's in front of you?
This vow to the living person who loves you and is also not dead. The easiest way to break a promise is for the other person to die. I don't know. That's just that's oh just my God. Like
very dark, but
so
valid.
Dark, but true. And they tersely come to this very stupid agreement. Where they're like, all right, well, we're going to wait and see if you're pregnant from the one time that I came inside of you.
You know,
we're having
because
sex.
That's how this works.
Once we figure out if you've gotten pregnant through all of your all of your attempts, then we'll decide what we do. If you're not pregnant, we're just going to live separate lives. What? If you are pregnant, I will do everything I can to provide for you and our child reluctantly because I didn't want one.
Oh, my God. God.
It's the strangest, most nonsensical agreement. If anything, it should be like, if you don't get pregnant, okay, baby, we're chilling. Like, just don't
then we're
make
good.
Me do that
then
again.
We keep. Yes.
And then if it's like, if you have the kid, fine, I'll provide for you and the kid. I want them to have a good life. But I'm going to be mad at you a lot for a long time. Like, even if that was the agreement, I'd be like, okay. But now the stakes that they're setting with this conversation is that now Daphne wants to be pregnant. Now she's like, the only way my relationship with him is going to continue in a meaningful way is if I'm pregnant.
And here's where you see kind of the emotional immaturity of the Duke, where he is very mature in some ways. Yeah. But this is where you kind of see just how he just learned resentment and he learned how to use that against the people around you. And that's what he's projecting right now.
We get to this concert that everybody in the town is attending.
Every evening there's an event.
If you're an introvert, you can go fuck yourself.
Ooh, fuck yourself.
Not in this era, you're not.
If you're an introvert, you're Penelope.
I'm like, if you're an introvert, you're Simon. You're miserable all the time.
True is what that is also true. You see the two types of introverts. You're either Penelope, where people kind of find you a little annoying. Aww. And not very important because you stay away.
Yeah.
Or you're Simon, where people are now intrigued. And you know what? Maybe that's just the difference between being a woman and a man at this point.
It is.
You're Simon, where your reluctancy to participate in society is seen as intriguing.
It's mysterious and hot.
It's mysterious and hot.
Whereas, God forbid, you're a woman and everyone's like, what's wrong with her?
So at this concert, Benedict sees Sir Granville and asks him about his relationship with Lord Wetherby,
who's the man that he was consorting with at their art orgy.
So this conversation is brought to showcase how the queer community during this time managed the challenges of this society. Sir Granville is part of a privileged group of people who were able to make marriage arrangements that accommodated their lifestyle.
which I'm sure was very difficult to do because it was very difficult to find someone who was like, do you,
who was willing to be discreet and willing to be accepting of that and be like, hey, all right, yeah, you do you and I will do me. And that's very much how you see Sir Granville and his wife operate, where they have these parties at their home. He gets to be with who he wants and she gets to be with whoever she wants.
It's very, everybody leaves their phones in a dish that we keep in a lock cabinet because ain't none of y'all gonna expose me. And guess what I've got? Mutual destruction, baby. You come out against me, you were there.
So you come to understand this is how he's able to pursue his relationship with Lord Weatherby. Lord Weatherby, on the other hand, he is a single man in this society who's actively courting other women, as is expected of him. So Benedict poses the question, you know, what about honor? What about romance? Granville kind of resents this question. And it's like, what do you know about honor and romance? Like, I risk my life every single day in the name of love. And that sounds pretty romantic. And he goes on to say, it takes courage to live outside the traditional expectations of society. You talk about doing the same, but I think it's all talk.
I think you can't fucking hack it.
Right after he has this conversation with Benedict, he resolves to leave the concert to find Madame Delacroix. As he's getting ready to leave, Eloise decides to tag along with him so that he can drop her off at home.
Yeah. She's like, I'm done with this.
I'm done with this. Can I come home? And he's like, okay, but I'm going to go pick up a friend and I need you to not say anything. And they've already established that Eloise and Benedict have a bit of rapport. They're a bit closer. They confide in each other more than they confide in their other siblings.
For sure.
They feel like they don't fit into this mold that society has put on them. Mm-hmm. They go pick up Madame Delacroix. Through conversation, Eloise starts to suspect that she may be Lady Whistledown because she mentioned something about the concert. And Madame Delacroix goes, oh, but the Featheringtons aren't there. And then Eloise is like, oh, yeah. And Madame Delacroix always has juicy gossip from working as a modiste and talking to females.
And hearing everything all the time.
So she starts putting these pieces together.
And Eloise is almost like, she's also kind of been in cahoots even with the queen. Because the queen is like, I need to know who Lady Whistledown is so I can probably cut off her hands and then keep her in the Tower of London for a few years. Can you help me find her if you're also looking for her? Eloise, naively, and also because she's the queen, is like, oh my God, yeah.
But she doesn't know that the queen is resentful of
Lady She doesn't Whistledown. Know until, right, she doesn't know until the curious. End of the season. Yeah. So Eloise is like, yeah, of course. Of course I'll help you do that. Now her quote unquote investigation of Lady Whistledown has stakes where now the queen is expecting something from her. And the queen is an asshole, right? So anytime Eloise is like, I think I have a clue. The queen is like, you haven't found out who she is yet. I don't fucking care about your clues. Shut up.
Now, this episode ends up closing out on Daphne discovering that she has gotten her period, confirming that she is not pregnant. While at the same time in town, Marina is found face down by Penelope after ingesting a homemade concoction that she made hoping to get rid of her pregnancy.
And this isn't explicitly said, but you can infer if Marina is making some random fucking weird tea, it's because she's trying to loosen this child from her womb.
Correct. Proving that reproductive rights, education, and care were and continue to be important in every century.
What is it that I'm going to say? Vote! 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 Unless you're a lawmaker, write some new laws. Laws! Laws! Laws!
So, closing out on that juxtaposition of these two women in this society is poignant. The way that you're seeing these two experiences of these two women, not well informed, not having the proper care that they need, going through the experience of, you know, becoming pregnant or not. Something that I found interesting as we're closing this out is as Daphne runs back to go to the restroom, where he's sitting, he can hear her breakdown and cry.
So they have a box at this like strings concert. So we keep cutting between Daphne and Marina in these like moments. Mm-hmm. And this entire scene is happening under this really strong classical music string piece. I forget the name of it.
So the musical sequence that plays over the unwinding of Daphne's situation and Marina's situation is Vivaldi's Four Seasons. And this specific movement is summer. This specific section of this movement is called Storm. And the way that it's so intense, this particular movement is supposed to depict somebody in distress. There's a storm coming, and that's exactly what you get from these violins playing at this frequency. It is so fitting to this scene. As you're watching it, it invokes this anxiety and distress. What they're waiting for is the answer to their problems.
Yes.
Marina getting rid of this pregnancy fixes her problems.
Yep.
Daphne ending up pregnant doesn't fix her problem, but it definitely makes it a lot better if she doesn't have to live separately to the Duke and they don't have to live their lives apart, which is what he said. You know, something that you catch at the tail end of this is the Duke's reaction when he hears Daphne sobbing in the background and he knows that it's because she knows that she's gotten her period. In this scene, he cries because he's also disappointed that now he's got to keep this promise that he made that they have to live separate lives.
Stay making promises, yo. Stay making promises, you fucking dumbass. After that, episode wraps. Episode 8, baby. Titled.
After the Rain. Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. titled After the Rain. So in this episode, After the Rain, the London season is officially going to conclude with the very last ball, the Hastings Ball, Daphne's first ball thrown as the Duchess of Hastings. So huge deal. The Danbury Ball was the opening ball of the 1813 London social season. The Hastings Ball is the closer.
I think that's kind of full circle for Danbury and Simon.
The Duke and Duchess of Hastings are preparing to host this ball. And they're getting their portrait painted, which is, again, we discussed this. If you guys have listened to our prior episodes, we discussed this more at length in our discussion of the movie Belle. Portraits take a very long time, especially painting them back in the day in the style of portraits of that era of the 1800s. Maybe you could say like, oh, they take a few weeks, right? But like, they don't take 3 days or 4 days, which is the amount of time we as the audience are to believe this painting took. Like, I'm so upset for Mr. Granville.
He was working day and night.
He hasn't slept in a 48 week.
Hours.
So I'm just, okay, the dresses, the paintings. All right, Nadja, now I'm going to shut up. We're suspending our disbelief, okay? They're getting their portrait done as a couple by Sir Granville, the Ton's favorite painter. And as they're sitting for this portrait, they're kind of murmuring to each other how they will separate their lives going forward. So Daphne's pretty much like, this is the last thing that we're going to do together. You need to stay for the ball. You need to stay with me in London until the season is formally over, because if you leave before I do, it's going to look bad and people are going to talk about us. So pretend you're fucking in love with me, I guess, and like make it until the end of the season and then go off and fucking do whatever you want. Don't make me look bad.
And as they're having this conversation, Granville is like trying to paint them and they're like oceans away from each other.
Like they're the COVID 6 feet mandated apart.
Truly. Simon has his arm out and he's quite literally an arm's length away.
Fully extended.
And Granville's like, I can't do this. Can you guys please get closer together?
Yeah, you look stupid.
And then he asks him again, like, hey, okay, what if you touch her shoulder? Let's try this.
He puts his hand on her shoulder like he's never had a hand to put on something before.
However, when they do touch, it kind of breaks this wall that they have between them. Through their anger and all their shit, they look at each other and you still see the tenderness. You're just so annoyed because you see how much they like each other. And they have very good chemistry. Phoebe and Reggae Jean Page, like, they really do share good chemistry on screen.
Yeah, their chemistry read must have been something. They share this tender look. And listen, I'm going to say that Mr. Henry Granville, I think he's being a little hyperbolic in this moment. But as they share this very precious looking tender look, Mr. Granville's like, my word, the very picture of devotion. Girl, if you don't chill, there are two people looking at each other. Goddamn. So he works on their portrait at the speed of motherfucking light. They don't need to pose again. They just pose the one time.
The one time.
We cut over from this scene of utter fantasy to the Featherington home. Marina turns out to be okay, even though she looks like absolute dog ass, because this tea just gave her some tummy trouble and made her pass out.
She thinks it did something, though. She really thinks she got rid of that. She's done.
She really thinks she did something. But even as the viewer, you're like, bitch, you did nothing. Like, it was a literal go girl, give us nothing. Not this tea. Like,
did you bleed out? No, you're still though. Pregnant.
Exactly. And it's like, because you as the viewer don't see, and I'm sure we've all seen in some form of media or another, like a traumatic like miscarriage scene, or like even with Daphne, like she gets her period when she doesn't want it. Like, you would not be missing this drama. If that happened to Marina, the viewer would absolutely know about it.
Absolutely.
So she says that she's fine. She's recovering. She apologizes to Penelope for the situation with Colin. And, you know, she gives her some credit. She's like, you know, he's really lucky that he has you. And one day he'll realize that. I know you were defending him and I know you care about him. But like, one day he'll figure out how valuable you are, basically. Marina's not stupid. She's bratty, but she's not stupid. She's had eyes on Penelope this whole time. Mm-hmm. As much as it was shitty to scam on this man Penelope had no claim to, like, she knew of Penelope's interest in Colin.
And she bashed her for it.
Yeah.
Now that the situation's over, she can be like, oh, we're gonna let bygones be bygones.
Yeah.
You deserve him. One day he'll realize how great you are.
He's a good person. It's very weird. So Marina unexpectedly receives a visit from none other than Sir Philip Crane. Marina trips. Like, she goes dun, pale. Dun, dun. She kind of starts to panic. And everybody's like, who the fuck is Philip Crane? And she goes, it's George's brother. He's like this very handsome man, well-dressed, arrives in a curricle, which is like a carriage, but it's open air. As the Featherington women and the Bridgerton women, so Daphne and Lady Bridgerton, walk into the Featherington home and are acquainted with Sir Philip Crane, Marina is like sitting on a couch in the sitting room, like despondent. Like, she's like, all face is like ashen. And they're like, cool, like, why are you here? And he's like, well, I just came with like the really awful news that George died in battle several weeks ago. I didn't know what was happening with Marina and I didn't know where she was. So I didn't know to tell her or how to tell her.
Until they received the letter from Daphne that she sent earlier.
To the general. She had reached out to the general, who had gotten everybody in touch with each other. He's like, you know, when I received the letter from the general, I realized that you didn't know that George had died. And I needed to come here and tell you. But I also wanted to come here because it's the right thing to do for me to offer you my hand in marriage. You are carrying my brother's child. My brother can't take care of you. And I know he would have wanted me to. I mean, obviously in the modern day, you're like, ew. But at the time, that was the honorable thing to do. Especially like if you gave a shit about your brother, which it seems like he did. It seems like they had a good relationship. Mm-hmm, so it's mm-hmm. like, I don't want the woman that he cared about and his child to be on the fucking street living in a boarding house or some shit. I want to take care of you. Lady Featherington very helpfully adds, for the reference of the viewer, Marina, he's the eldest son. He inherits the title. This is a very acceptable proposal.
Well, she even implies you may even be able to take care of your cousins.
Lady Featherington is wild.
She looking for her bag everywhere.
I'm dead.
She looking for that bag under the couch. Anywhere she could look for her bag, she's looking.
I'm deceased. She's a schemer. And Marina's like, fuck that. I don't know this man. I don't love this man. This is not my man.
Like, suddenly she's all very righteous about being with a man that she doesn't know and doesn't love.
She becomes overwhelmed. She leaves the room. Daphne follows her and they have a conversation where Marina, it seems reluctant. I know she's supposed to be overcome with grief, but like, she's like, you know, I never would have learned any of this if you hadn't like made it a mission to like seek out the general and find out more information. Mm-hmm. Like, thank you so much. And pretty much reinforces like, you know, but this is done now. I'm not pregnant anymore. But they found a letter in George's things that he didn't get the chance to send before he died, where he was telling me how much he loved me and how excited he was that when he got home, we were going to get married. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, she spent the last like 2 months basically like he doesn't love me.
Or maybe even hating him.
Yes.
And blaming him.
And she even says, she's like, I thought him a villain.
Yes. And now she feels terrible for thinking that.
Yeah.
After finding out he had died and he had every intention of taking responsibility for their child and marrying her and taking care of her, and not just in the sense of taking care of her, but he loved her as well.
Yeah, so she's obviously bereft.
And if you're a book reader and you've read through the Bridgerton novels, this storyline continues through to book 4 or 5, I believe.
5.
Which is actually titled A Letter from Sir Philip. You recognize Sir Philip's name, and I'm not sure how they're going to portray this part of the story in the Bridgerton verse.
Because Sir Philip is supposed to be a widower.
And his wife Marina passes away in a tragic way. Yeah. So we don't know how Bridgerton's going to explore that, or if they're going to change that, or if they're going to leave it. I am very interested to know. I cannot wait for Eloise's season.
Yeah, so we're kind of skipping around a little bit with this episode, but just to wrap up Marina's storyline, you know, she rejects this proposal from Sir Philip. She's like, no, I'm not pregnant. Within the next few days, bitch, yes the fuck you are. T wasn't gonna do shit. She feels kicking in her belly because at this point, she's probably at the end of her first trimester, which is around the time that you would feel a flutter in your tummy. And so she's starting to feel some stuff. I think I'm still pregnant. We need a doctor. The doctor's like, dumb bitch, you thought T was gonna fix this? If you don't fucking get married, Lord. And then she's like, between her and Lady Featherington, Lady Featherington's like, yeah, you're a dumb idiot. You had a perfectly respectable, totally fine, very kind seeming man ready to just take you fucking home and take care of you.
And handsome.
Yeah, he was handsome. Okay. They basically like write to Sir Philip again and they're like, hey, I'm just kidding. Like, I changed my mind. Please, please propose to me again. And he comes and gets her. And that's her storyline. And she has this very tender moment with Lady Featherington where she's like, how did you do it? How have you done it for 22 years, right? Like, because Lady Featherington and Lord Featherington,
everyone knows they don't fuck with each other. They have no affection for each other.
If anything, they're ships in the night. They're acquaintances and like they're business associates. Marina's like, how did you do it? How did you build this life with your fucking business associate? And Lady Featherington, I mean, I think in one of her most genuine moments, she's like, you find things and then you have children and then you love your children and you build your home.
Like, you make your happiness. Yeah.
You make your happiness and you keep going and you pour yourself into your children. Obviously, because that's your only option in this society at that time. You pour yourself into your children and you keep going. And Marina's kind of like not super convinced by this. But Lady Featherington is like, you're strong. Like, you're strong and you're tough and you will be okay.
That's the most motherly moment, like genuine motherly moment that she has the whole time.
Ugh.
And it wasn't even with one of her biological daughters.
It was with a distant cousin. Yeah, I know. That happens over the course of several different scenes, but that wraps up Marina's storyline in Bridgerton season one. So going back to what's the event, right, of this episode, we're already looking forward to the Hastings Ball, but the other event of this episode is a fight. There's a new prize fight where Will Mondrich is favored to win in this prize fight against like some Irish bare knuckle boxer, right? Everyone is laying down bets on this fight. Tons of money is going around. It's a real FanDuel DraftKings situation out here. Who do we know that loves FanDuel and DraftKings? Lord Featherington.
Dun dun dun.
That dumb bitch.
And everybody's betting for Will Mondrich to win.
Yes.
So he goes to Will and he's like, hey, what if I bet against you and you lose on purpose? And then I split the winnings with you in half.
Because to Lord Featherington, he's like, I'm in a desperate situation. No one is taking our money anymore. My family's dragged through the mud because of the gossip papers. I don't have any more credit to run up. I have nothing. Like, I have nothing left to give, right? Mm-hmm. I need to have a big win. If I can set it up with you, you can also have a big win.
And he pretty much tells him, like, how long do you plan on fighting?
This is something that pisses me off so much because, of course, I think the interactions with Will, because he's a prize fighter, because he has to use his body to make a living, I think are way more racially charged.
Well, no, and he even tells him, like, what would your father say? Your father who escaped the colonies, made his way here. What would your father say if his son is just
a prize fighter?
A prize fighter.
I don't know. It's a moment of so much insult.
Because he's patronizing him.
Yes. It's like, do you really think you're going to do this forever? You think you're going to fight forever? What about your kids? It's so fucking icky. And it's like from Lord Featherington, who has never worked a day in his fucking life. And all he does is gamble and lose. So you're like, who are you? Like, what are you doing?
What nerve? Yeah. What nerve do you have, sir?
Everything he says strikes a big chord in Will where he's like, fuck, am I going to do this forever? I do want to take care of
my family. I can't do this forever. This is how my family has a living. What happens when I can't continue to do this? Then I leave my wife with what? You know, he actually takes this conversation to his wife.
Yeah.
And if there's something we learn about his wife, is she's like, she's about her bag too.
Ella una tigra.
They don't really have a lot of dialogue, but by her expression, and then he turns and agrees with Lord Featherington, you know that they're on an understanding.
She's reluctant.
They're both reluctant.
Doesn't love it.
No, he was more reluctant than she. I think she's convinced more ways. So she's like, oh, I got some money. Okay, maybe we can make that work. He's more about his honor.
Yeah, his integrity.
There's something interesting he says later on to the Duke when the Duke questions him, mm-hmm. where he's like, what's more honorable than taking care of your family?
Because, spoiler alert, Mondrich loses the fight. He throws the match. Lord Featherington wins fucking huge. The mistake fucking Lord Featherington makes, which we see throughout the course of this fight, is that nobody will bet with him anymore because he can never pay back his debts. Now he is called like the worst people in town. And this is why you know they're bad. One of them has a big scar right on his face. He calls the worst people in town, who he has still apparently not had any issues with, and is like, I need to bet huge because I think the other fighter opposite Mondrich is called like the Beast. I think the Beast is going to win. And the two guys are like, Mondrich is favored to win in every metric. Like, why would we do that bet with you? And they're like, everyone in town knows your word is worth nothing. Why would mm-hmm. we bet with you? And he's like, all right, guys, like, you don't have to believe me. I'm just going to give you the deed to my house.
My goodness, bro.
And the guys are like, what? Like, and they're clearly confused, but, you know, they agree to this bet. And as Lord Featherington leaves, they look at each other and you can tell that they're like, we're going to take this fucking guy for a ride. Kind of like regardless of the outcome.
We're going to get ours.
He's cooked. Yeah. Yeah. Lord Featherington wins fucking huge. He gets enough money in these like weird handwritten banknotes to pay off the bulk of their debt. They settle their credit with the modiste and they settle their credit with some of the servants and blah, 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 blah. He has split half with Mondrich. So now Mondrich is like sitting on a nest egg. Now he's got to use that to establish a legacy for his family. Hastings, Simon, goes into like the fighter's tent or like the prep area after the fight has concluded because it's not supposed to be terribly obvious to the viewer. It's only because you know it's happening. But mm-hmm. it's kind of obvious that he threw the fight because he is fighting hard and fucking killing it. And he's not winded. He's not beat up. The other guy is like struggling. And then he takes like 3 hits and he's like, no, I'm down. I'm out. Sorry.
Oh, man, I cannot get up.
Oh, no. Oh, no, the fight. And then like everyone else is like, oh, shit. But like you see Simon be like, what the fuck is happening? And when he goes to see him after, he's like, what are you doing? And Will is like, I did what I had to do. He kind of parrots some of the same stuff that Lord Featherington says. Like, I can't do this shit forever. I'm looking out for my family. This is just a way that I had to do it.
And the Duke tries to, I think he's coming at him as a friend. Like, yo, dude, if you needed help, I could have helped you.
Right.
You know, and Mondrick just kind of like, this is a way of me trying to pave a way for myself and my family. And he's like, oh, what would your wife say? Almost implying that he did it behind his wife's back.
Right. As if they don't like, discuss everything.
Mondra's like, we're good. Why don't you worry about you and your wife?
Yep.
It's like, ooh, hey. And then finishes off with, what is more honorable than taking care of your family? And I think that struck a chord with the Duke where he's holding on to all of this honor bullshit because of this vow he had with his father. And he's ignoring his family for it.
His alive, breathing, with a pulse family.
Exactly.
The stupidity, it just knows no bounds. Yeah, now Simon's gears are turning, right? He's left thinking. Another thing that happens at this fucking boxing match, which is unhinged, is that Sienna has a new, like, gentleman caller that she goes out in public with. Sienna, the opera singer who was involved with Anthony Bridgerton.
Because everyone is at this fight. The Bridgertons are at this. Everyone's at this fight.
It's huge, huge business. Anthony keeps locking eyes with Sienna. Again, she's there with a gentleman caller who takes her out in public. So it's like, this man is, he's cool. He's chilling with hanging out with Sienna on purpose. Anthony could never do that. So they lock eyes, and it is like this unspoken fucking moment where they meet up with each other underneath the bleachers and just fuck, you know, in public. What the hell?
Under the bleachers. Like, wow, what? You need it real bad. You need it real, real bad. Goodness me.
It's supposed to be like, you know, look at this undeniable chemistry between them. He's always going to be drawn to Sienna.
Yeah, horny motherfuckers.
Verdad. And so we cut from the boxing match. The only person for our purposes who's not at this boxing match is Daphne, because Daphne has a lot of prep that
for
she needs to do.
For our purposes.
Right? The people, yes, we care about.
That's right.
Because she's got a lot of prep to do for the Hastings Ball. The Hastings Ball, which on this incredibly wild accelerated timeline is in like 2 days or something. She and Simon have a brief interaction before he goes to the boxing match. Both of them are like kind of unhappy. In this interaction, he's kind of like, I had a really bad father. Like, I know you don't understand this vow that I've taken and you don't respect it or whatever. Like, it's just not meaningful to you. But like, to me, I could never be the kind of person that my father was. And I'm trying to avoid that at all costs. And like, if you don't understand that, fine. And so she's left thinking, because he's really not been transparent with her at all about what his upbringing was like outside of the fact that his father was absent and his mother died. So they're at Hastings' house. It's her house now, right? In London. And so she starts digging through this office, like this office that's been closed off, covered with the little white sheets. That's how you know no one's been there, baby. She knows it was the study of the former Duke of Hastings. And she's digging through the drawers. She's looking through his shit. She finds this stack of unopened letters, because, you know, letters at the time were sealed with like a wax seal. So it's very easy to tell whether or not they've been opened, and they wouldn't close again properly if they had been opened. None of these letters have been opened. And she finds them, sees who they're addressed to, the Duke of Hastings, and that they were sent from Cliveden, which is where Simon grew up alone. And she's like, what the fuck? And opens up all the letters and reads them. And by the end is just like brokenhearted. As she's finishing up reading one of these letters, who comes in but Lady Danbury, one of the only other people who knows enough about Simon's background to answer any of her questions. And Lady Danbury is like, hey, your mother and I are here to help you prep for the ball. I think you got a little lost in like whatever you were doing. And Daphne's like, yeah, sorry. Lady Danbury like kind of notices the letters and like knows what they are and doesn't really say anything yet. And Daphne's like, I think she has received such little clarity on the Duke of Hastings, like the former Duke of Hastings. Lady Danbury kind of tells her he was fucking terrible. He demanded perfection from his child, and he would accept nothing less than perfection. Essentially, that's why the Duke is the way he is. Daphne's like, you know, thank you so much for like what you did for him, right? Like the help that you gave him. And Lady Danbury's kind of like, all I did was be there for him, but he did the rest. I think that helps Daphne realize the way that I have to approach him is giving him a little push and letting him do the rest. Like, I have to be transparent with him, and then he'll just decide, right? Like, what it is that he wants to do. And, you know, the next big scene that we see is morning tea with the Bridgerton siblings. So Daphne joins the Duke for breakfast, which she hasn't done since they've started this ridiculous fucking fight. And he's kind of, like, pleasantly surprised that she's there, but also on his guard, because, like, what's going on? She encourages him to join her family for tea because her sister Francesca, who no one knows and they've never met, is back in town after spending the summer or part of the summer away in Bath learning how to play piano or becoming better at piano or whatever. Because he's getting ready to kind of be like, no, I don't think so. And she's like, my brothers will think it's really weird if you don't come with me. So I don't know. Make your decision.
Right. You decide if you want Anthony questioning you some more.
But it's totally up to you.
Right.
And she doesn't even know that they fought. Like, she doesn't know that Antony and the Duke are full beefing. And they go to her house. They see Francesca. Again, no one's ever met her before. I keep making that joke just because Francesca's like a ghost character. But
yeah, she is. But we are going to get to see her more in season 3.
We are. And we see Simon interacting with the youngest Bridgertons, who are Hyacinth and Gregory. And Hyacinth is probably like 9. And Gregory's probably supposed to be like 11. Gregory is at the end of his time of being instructed at home before he goes away to school. Hyacinth and Gregory are the closest in age, obviously, to each other. So they're always fucking around, chasing each other, playing a lot. Like, and they're two cuties. They are the cutest little child actors. Oh my God, it's insane.
I mean, I don't know how long Bridgerton's going to be around, but maybe if this goes on for another 5 years, we might get to see her herself play out her character's love story.
I was going to say, because they might have to do a time jump at some point. Like, if the show doesn't get renewed and they want to conclude all the plot lines kind of at the same time.
Why wouldn't it get renewed? Come on. Do you know the fandom behind this? There's endorsements everywhere.
Yeah.
Bed Bath & Body Works has...
Bed Bath & Body Works? That's a new store.
Cut me out. Cut me out. I'm so sorry.
I'm sorry. And, you know, we see Simon interacting with Gregory and Hyacinth, and he's killing it. He's doing a great job. He's so good with kids, which you would never guess, because I don't think he's ever been around any except for himself as a child. He does a little like origami. He like plays games with them, makes noises. Like, Daphne's watching him with like her ovaries alight.
Ooh.
Wanting to bear children so bad. And we also learned that Colin's a singer, and he's like singing a fun little song that I think it's Francesca like tapping out on the piano. Ryan hated this song. He thought it was the dumbest song ever. The catch and the toast, or the toast and the catch.
Old fucking songs are the worst.
Yeah, old songs are wild. It's like fish and bread.
It's like the songs me and my cousins make up when we're
like
when we were bored at 9 years old.
God, fish and bread. So
about like what you're eating.
Oh my God, I know exactly which song you're talking about. So yes, Colin is a lovely singer. As he's like singing the song and playing with Francesca, and the two little ones are like dancing around, Benedict goes to sit with Eloise. They're chatting, and Eloise is kind of like making fun of him for his relationship with Madame Delacroix. And it's just kind of like, listen, live your fucking life. Like, I'm hyped for you if that's what you want. If you like it, I love it. And Antony comes by and sits with them, and they immediately shut up. Like, because no one trusts Antony in this household. It's because he's like,
they're like, we saw what you did with Daphne. No, I'm good.
We saw what you did with Daphne. And on top of that, you're a fucking cop. Like, we don't like you.
Yo, for real. They treat him like he's the cop. They do.
Like, and he catches kind of the tail end of Benedict and Eloise's conversation, where he says something about Madame Delacroix. And he sits down and he's like, oh, Benedict, like, what are you talking about? And Benedict's like, he like takes a moment and like steals himself, and he's like, I've been spending time with Madame Delacroix. And Antony's like, hell yeah, nice. And then just like gets up and leaves. And both Eloise and Benedict are like, what the fuck just happened?
No, and I think this is coming from like the reigniting of him and Sienna's relationship a little bit.
Right.
And he's feeling hopeful.
He's feeling hopeful. And he's also like, oh, you want a connection with someone outside of society? Same. Same, bro.
Same.
And like, and just leaves them be. And both of them are like, what the fuck? As this is happening, Penelope enters. She is visiting Eloise, who's her friend, obviously. And now that the kind of like the marina business is behind them, right? Like, she's visiting Eloise again openly. And she sees Colin like singing. I mean, and he's a lovely singer. And she sees him like singing the song and playing with his siblings. And she is so like...
Another one. She don't know she got ovaries, but they're pumping too.
They are. She's like, I don't know how people get babies, but this might be part of it. And like, she's so about this man. And she goes and sits with, like, Eloise literally comes and pulls her. And it's like, Penelope, you're here. And she's frozen watching Colin. And they go and they sit on the couch together. And Eloise is like, you know, I think the modiste is Lady Whistledown. Like, she knows, you know, she knows all the gossip and like tradesperson, whatever. And Penelope's kind of like, oh, okay, cool. Like, how exciting. And Eloise is like, oh, I just think it's so amazing that, like, she's running a business and she's independent and da-da-da-da. Penelope's like, you know, you may aspire to the same type of future because your sister's a duchess, right? Like, all your other sisters are going to marry well and your brothers are going to marry well, and maybe you could do whatever you want. And she clarifies again, in case you as a viewer fucking forgot, that her family's not in the same position and that she probably won't be able to be as free and dedicate as much of herself to like a craft that she cares about, because she has to be a lot more aware of like a financial position when it comes to her family. Eloise thinks about this a little bit, and she has a moment later on, again, just to kind of wrap up this, we're jumping around a little, but to wrap up this part of the storyline, she has a moment where she goes to Daphne as they're beginning to prep like the opening of the Hastings ball. And Daphne is kind of like, has paid her a compliment saying that she looks very beautiful. Eloise is like super uncomfortable with compliments and super uncomfortable like in her skin. I feel like the way the actress plays Eloise like makes this apparent. Eloise is, you know, Daphne's kind of like, you know, I know that you think this is all stupid. Like, I think this is a really sweet moment. Like, it sounds like Daphne's actually a good sister and Eloise's issue, not issues with her.
I think Daphne's been a good, all she's been trying to do is be a good sister.
I think Eloise
And she just, she's just judged by
Eloise,
her younger sister, and then she feels like she needs to defend herself against, like, all these judgments from her.
I think, like, I think Daphne's been a very good sister. I think, yeah, Eloise has been judging her the whole time. And I also think that Eloise, like, it's almost like a frustration at the comparison because they're right behind each other in age. So the being frustrated at constantly being compared to someone, like, you know, you and I are further apart in age. There are ways that I'm compared to you that, or even vice versa. But I know growing up.
And it typically comes from like your parents.
Yes.
Like, oh, you know, your sister's doing this. Maybe you should do it too. Or, oh, look how great your sister did this thing.
Yeah.
Why aren't you doing it the same way? Yeah.
It pits you against each other when in reality, it should be pitting you both against your parents.
Hello.
So
we figured it out.
We sure did. I think, yeah. I think, like, for Eloise, like, she has this resentment that Daphne is the way that she is because it puts her in a position of almost, like, inferiority. Like, it puts her on defense that Daphne is, quote-unquote, better at being a woman, better at being a wife, better at being a debutante. And Eloise is, like, unpleasant and loud and opinionated, and she's a big feminist and, like, doesn't want these traditional things other people want for her, that the only things that are available to her. I don't even think it's like that she dislikes Daphne. I think it's the resentment of like, you're the example of everything I'm supposed to be, and the fact that you are in my family makes it so much worse.
Maybe. Yeah.
So she's been an asshole to Daphne like most of the time, and Daphne pays her a compliment. You look beautiful. I know you hate these events. I'm not going to judge you if you decide to leave. Thank you for coming and showing your face. Like, I really appreciate it. And then she's like, you know, I know there's not a lot that we agree on as sisters, I guess. But the one thing that we both know is that you will find your own way in this world. I don't know if it's Daphne giving her permission. Like, you don't have to be like me and you'll still be okay. Or if
I think there's a little bit of that.
Eloise says, I almost feel like you could perceive this as a dig, and I don't think it's meant to be a dig.
No, she said it earnestly, I believe. Yeah.
She says, thank you for being so perfect, so I do not have to be. As uncomfortable as she feels in society, a ton of that pressure is off of her because it was on Daphne, and Daphne bore it so much better than Eloise ever would.
Maybe. I mean, not that Eloise isn't capable.
No, it's that she doesn't want to. And it is a very, very sweet moment. It makes me tear up. So now we're officially at the Hastings Ball, motherfuckers. And it is the final ball of the season. It's extravagant. Everything's very beautiful. It seems like the ball is happening. Oh my God, the decor is stunning. And the ball is happening at Hastings' house. It's their ball. They seem to have a part of their house that's like an enclosed courtyard that's outdoors. Mm. It's like an uncovered courtyard surrounded by house and building.
Love that.
With a fountain at the center? I mean, shut up.
Love it.
It's got an incredible color scheme, okay? It's blue, black, white, lavender, like little bits of lavender. Like, but it is overall very cool toned. And I think you're kind of supposed to take from this that Bassett, Duke of Hastings, and Daphne Bridgerton, like, they're fully in a union. This is them going forward together. We're blending their colors now. And the Duke is actually wearing all black except for a blue and silver vest. Blue and silver are very, very Bridgerton. Very Bridgerton family colors. Daphne is wearing this gorgeous soft purple dress, which is very pastel. But again, that lavender, that purple is like mixing in the like deep burgundies of like Danbury and Hastings and Bridgerton and like bringing it together in like this really lovely way. It also kind of like is a little nod to Lady Danbury and her influence, right, in the Hastings family. As their guests start to arrive, we see the Mondriches in finery. And Simon is like, I think he's still frustrated at like the lack of integrity of like throwing a fight, but he's like, hell yeah, hell yeah.
I think he feels satisfied for them. And like, I think he feels hopeful that they're going to continue to hold their own and advance and in society, maybe.
Even though they're not necessarily part of, like, the Ton, it does make sense that they're there because Vondrich and the Duke are known to be good friends. So it's like, of course he would invite his friend to his party at his house. The Featherington women also arrive together, aside from that aborted public appearance at the Queen's luncheon. This is their first public appearance since the Marina scandal. And they were actually invited specifically in person by Daphne because Lady Featherington, again, forever in pursuit of her bag, approaches Daphne out in public. Like, they literally just come across each other in public with, like, their ladies' maids at a shop or whatever. And she goes up to her and she's like, you know, it's so sad, everything that's going on. We haven't been out in society. My daughters are beside themselves. And we hope you have this incredible ball, but I know that you know we're not invited. And it's very, like, fucking stupid. Like, I...
We can't wait to hear all about it.
We can't wait to hear about it the next day. From Lady Whistledown. Like, it's so dumb. And Daphne, in spite of her mother, because Lady Bridgerton is still fucking pissed at Lady Featherington. Because she's like, you fucking knew. And you were going to put my son in that situation. You're dead to me.
You're dead.
You're dead. Daphne, in like, oh, we're in a spirit of forgiveness. Like, my mother keeps telling me I need to forgive my husband. And, like, that I need to rebuild my relationships. And she's like, well, you know, in the spirit of forgiveness and putting all this behind us, you should come to the ball. You should come and, like, spend some time with us. Meanwhile, Lady Bridgerton is like, I'll flame you with my fucking eyes. Like, she's so angry. But she's like, yes, of course. It's like a whole thing. And as the Featherington women arrive in their disgusting dresses, Colin walks up to Penelope from across the ball to tell her formally in person that he has taken her advice and he will be going on his European tour of Greece. And he's going to be gone for several months at least. And Penelope is so fucking taken off guard.
I mean, she knew this was happening, though. He was talking about it.
She's dumb.
Weeks before. And while he was courting Marina, she was encouraging him.
So Penelope's like super caught off guard. And she's like, okay, well, have a great time, halfway in tears, and literally runs away from the ball. Like, she's done. He invites her to dance, which she denies. She just can't handle it and leaves the ball. And Colin is left looking after Penelope as she leaves, both stupid and confused. One could say he's confused because of how stupid he is. So Eloise at this moment is like, I think that the modiste is Lady Whistledown. And she's been working with the queen to try and figure out, like, what the fuck is up. The last time Eloise goes to speak with the queen and is like, oh, I think it's a tradesperson, this is my clue, the queen shuts her down, which we mentioned before. Now she's trying to approach the queen, who is at this ball. Brimsley, the queen's top dog, blocks her and is like, one does not simply approach the queen. And Eloise is like, but I need to talk to her. Bitch, she's not a regular fucking person. Eloise, why are we brand new? And she's like, yeah, no, she doesn't need to talk to you. And Eloise is like, she has to take a different tact because Brimsley is also not that nice. And she's like, okay, well, flattery works for everyone. And she's like, oh, you know what? Like, she told me, like, you guys were hiring Bow Street runners. We hear it in an earlier episode that the queen had decided to hire a team of Bow Street runners. Bow Street runners were the law enforcement officers of the city of Westminster, which is like the interior most close-knit part of London. Like, London is like a very sprawling city, but the city of Westminster is at the center of London, and it's like where all of the stuff is. So they were like a version of a metropolitan police force. And she calls upon the Bow Street Runners, puts together a task force.
That's a dope name, though. You imagine?
I know.
Like, they sound like a rap group.
Bow Street Runners. That's so...
No, maybe not a rap group. maybe more like...
Maybe an indie band.
Maybe an indie band. Yes. Dashboard Confessionals.
Bow Street Runners.
Yes.
Done.
Yes.
Eloise is like, yeah, I heard from the queen that she hired these Bow Street runners to find Lady Whistledown. Like, I bet that was your idea. Like, you seem so smart and, like, cool. And Brimsley's like, actually, it totally was. He's like, little do you know.
Hair behind the ear.
It totally was my idea. And I'm so glad you knew that. I am very smart. They have a plan. Brimsley, one of the moments where you're like, Brimsley, shut the fuck up. He's like, you know, we have a plan to unmask the writer tonight. We got a tip that she delivers her papers to the printing press during the ball so that no one from the Ton is out in the streets. And tonight we're going to sit on that printing press and we're going to catch her in the act. And Eloise is like,
What?
In distress. Like, now she's beginning to understand, like, oh shit, the queen's gonna do something bad to Lady Whistledown.
She understands she wants to silence her.
Yes.
Silence her. She wants her to write no more.
And behead her or something. I'm joking. But, like, keep her in whatever way, legal, extra legal, from printing gossipy shit, especially gossipy shit about the queen.
Or not endorsed by the queen.
Exactly. Because Eloise's initial assumption of why the queen wanted to know who Lady Whistledown was because the queen was like, I really want her to write specifically what I want her to write. I want her only want my stuff and she and I can work together. And Eloise was like, oh, cool. And now she's like, oh, shit, no. Like, that would actually be really bad. And so she's like, shit. And she's thinking, she's like, I have to go warn her. She goes to Benedict and she's like, hey, can we leave this ball? And Benedict is like, I'm going to stay. Like, what are you doing? And she's just like, fuck. And she leaves the ball anyway, because now she knows where Lady Whistledown is going to deliver her thing. And she wants to save her. She doesn't want her to be silenced by the queen. As she goes to, like, one of the carriages, she goes to, like, the footman of this carriage. Footman John!
Footman John. This is our first interaction with Eloise and Footman John, trying to pay him to do her work.
We love Footman John.
To drive her around.
Footman John is an ally.
He is an ally.
So she goes to the footman and he's like, I can't leave this ball with you. Like, we're not going to leave. You have to stay there with your family. And Eloise is like, I've got a ton of spending money that I will fucking give you if you take me where I want to go. And you see in his face that he's kind of like, ugh. But then he's like, fine. And his jawline is also not quitting. I mean, this man, it's square jaw. It's dimple chin. Like, he's out here footmaning.
He put his footman in that.
He put his whole foot in that man. What? That's not right.
What? I don't know. So sorry.
Footman John. So then we catch another Bridgerton sibling, Anthony. Anthony, also known as Anthony to the American viewer. We catch Anthony, who's not yet at the ball. He is late, as he appears to be to almost everything. And his carriage pulls up to, like, this nondescript townhouse. He knocks on the door. We understand this to be where Sienna is. He's got a bouquet of flowers. Like, he's going to wine and dine her. Like, he's really taking her with him to this ball. Anthony comes face to face with, like, her gentleman caller, who is relieved by Sienna, who's, like, clearly not dressed for this ball. And they basically have their breakup conversation, where Anthony's like, wait, what do you mean? I'm the one in control of the situation, and I was totally willing to take you out in front of my family. What do you mean you don't want to be with me? And Sienna's like, I'm not going to embarrass myself in front of this entire society. Basically, to, like, stroke your ego. Kind of like, yeah, I care about you, but, like, this was not fucking meant to be. You've got lots of different obligations, and I'm determined to live my life in a certain way that is not compatible with how you live your life. That's that. I'm sorry. It's not fucking meant to be.
I'm not about this life.
Exactly. Like, she's got her gentleman caller who's cool with her, down with her shit.
She doesn't need to pretend to be
someone different. She can just be opera singing Sienna. Anthony kind of has a moment where you can tell, like, he wants to fight, but he also is feeling, like, very defeated because she is so matter of fact. She's sad. Like, she's crying. They're both kind of crying, but, like, this is what it is. And he just has a moment where he's like, okay, yeah, you're right. Dumps the flowers that look very beautiful and expensive. He leaves. He's sad, broken up with, bereft, heartbroken. So we get back to the ball where the matriarchs, Lady Danbury, Lady Bridgerton, share some final words of advice with their respective children. Children charges. Lady Danbury tells Simon that he cannot be maneuvered by his pride, that he'll be left with nothing, just emptiness, if he continues to operate off of his pride. And Violet tells Daphne, listen, love is a choice that you make every day. And this is something, like, that I have taken to saying since watching the show for the first time, because I loved the sentiment so much. Like, you're gonna have bad days that are stupid, and then you still have to choose to love each other even though your days are bad and stupid.
Right, because there are more important things, there are better things there. I mean, I think Violet gets a little shit from the general public because she's always so positive. And it's like, there's light at the end of the tunnel, you know, love. Like, there's light on the other end, and there's love. And but I think there's this moment where Violet gives you a bit of a peek into her grief for her husband.
Yeah.
You don't see that because she's always portraying so much positivity and light and love. And she's pretty much saying, like, you know, yeah, like, I'm sad now. But what makes me happy is that I know that we lived a good, a well-loved life. Just saying, like, they had hard times too. And
yeah, they had hard times and they loved each other and they worked through them and they lived happily for the time that they had, which was like they were together for almost 20 years. But like, yeah, her husband died like very prematurely and the whole family like really feels that loss. And there are even a few shots kind of, especially in this episode, I think, where you see Violet waking up in bed alone, right? Because she's a widow, and turns over as if she's expecting her husband to be there.
Oh, yes.
Which is very sad.
I mean, by context of all of their lives, it wasn't that long ago. It's only Hyacinth's age. So like maybe nine or 10 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, like nine, 10 years. Yeah, and that's kind of like, I think Daphne also gets, that also puts Daphne in this mindset of like, I'm wasting a lot of time. Or like, oh, this is maybe a waste.
Right, but I also think it makes her realize like she's idolized this like love match between her and her mother and her father.
Right.
And I think maybe it's the first time that Violet kind of confesses like, hey, it wasn't always awesome.
Yeah.
Like it sucked sometimes and we had to work at it. And we had to, during hard times, we had to choose to love each other and move forward. And forgiveness was a big part of that.
Mm-hmm. And Daphne's like, shit. Yeah, maybe you're right.
You know, kind of breaking down this idea of perfection, which is, I think, the ideal that's been associated with Daphne from the very beginning, right? The queen calls her flawless. She wants to have a perfect love match. She's seeking this perfection. And now she sees her life and her marriage being affected by the perfection that was asked of the Duke.
Mm. And we're gonna cut back a little bit to a moment just before the ball started where Daphne and Simon are like preparing, they're taking a little breath before all the guests arrive, and they have this moment where they kind of fall into that banter that they had at the start of the season, right, when they were just fooling everybody, just being goofs, making jokes. And Daphne's like, you know, it's our ball, we have to dance at least three dances together. This is something that's commented on in the book, but like apparently dancing three dances, even if it was with your wife or your betrothed, was like scandalous. It was
like a lot. Like, whoa, can you guys get a room?
Which is so,
this is like your third dance.
I can't even handle how stupid I think that is, but fine. And like apparently two dances was like tasteful. So she's like, at least three dances, like it's our ball. Just to provide a little context to that joke. And the Duke is like, no more than two. Three, that's excessive. And then they're both kind of like, okay, one last dance. And then they kind of like look at each other and laugh a little bit. And they're about to have a moment. And then the guests start to arrive. And the moment is broken. When they begin this like big dance that they open, everybody's kind of gathered on the edges of this like dance area around the fountain. It's like a stunning visual to watch them dance. And there's a lot of like pop music that's incorporated into the show. A lot of things that are made classical. A lot of modern music that's done in a string quartet or whatever that is like interspersed with the music of the show. We heard a movement from Vivaldi earlier in the series or earlier in the season, right? In like episode 6. Now we get another movement from Vivaldi, which is from the Spring Concerto movement of the Four Seasons. And spring is obviously like relevant because the London season begins in the spring. Daphne and Simon are in the spring of their relationship at the beginning of everything. It's also this very kind of like bouncy and light feeling melody that is played kind of like staccato on several different string instruments or violins rather. And they begin, it's like this bouncy dance that they do where they're bouncing around the the fountain. Mm-hmm. Sounds cringe when I describe it with words. It looks beautiful on the screen. So a fun fact of this Vivaldi movement is that Vivaldi divided each of his concertos into three movements, fast, slow, and fast again. And that's kind of like Simon and Daphne's romance. Like fast, slow, because now they're mad, and then we're going to get fast again. Like,
well, it's also how they do the dance.
Yes.
They break the slow motion.
They do. Oh, they do like a little slow motion, like, yep. Yeah, that's super fun. Paola fucking loves this song. She'll dance to it now. She'll crump to this song. Crump, Dougie, Millie Rock. She'll do every fucking dance
this
to this
song. This song is a whole bop. I dare you to put on, I'm going to give you the name so you can look it up. I dare you to put on Vivaldi's for season spring one, and I dare you not to bop. I dare you.
I'm dead. But okay. We've described the setting of this ball, right? Being in kind of this open air courtyard that's at the center of their home. It's stunning, but what fucking happens? It starts to rain. And guess what, bitch? You're outside. It's starting to rain on you. As the thunder, this like thunder rumbles, they start to get these slow drops of rain. The dance breaks up. Everybody kind of picks up and gets underneath awnings to avoid getting wet, right? Everyone except Daphne and the Duke. Now they're just in the, as the rain gets heavier and heavier, now they're just in the rain kind of having a moment with each other. And of course, Queen, Matriarch, Lady Danbury is like, all right, guys, ball's over. Because she sees that there's like some shit brewing in this chat they're about to have. And she's like, we're done. Y'all ain't got to go home, but you got to get the hell up out of here. Everyone goes to leave the ball. Daphne finally has her big moment because it's this crack in the veneer of her perfection. She's having this perfect ball. Guess what? It starts to rain. You can't control the fucking rain. Not even the Duke can control the weather. She's just like, I'm just going to take my moment. I'm going to feel the rain on my skin. No one else can feel it for me. Only I can let it in. You're an idiot. No one else can feel speak the words on my lips.
Skin. No one else can feel it for you.
Today is where we both begin.
Yeah, quite literally, this is very fitting. they should have made a classical
one. They should have made a classical one and not used Vivaldi in this part. Wow.
Nah. Always use Vivaldi.
I'm dead.
Put some respect on Vivaldi.
So she finally has this moment of like, where she kind of unburdens herself. Like she takes this opportunity, this like break of perfection where they don't need to have a face on anymore. They're literally getting fucking rained on. The Duke is kind of like, Daphne, what are you doing? Like, we're in the rain. Like, you're getting wet.
Well, he also starts apologizing, right, for it not going well.
And that's when she says the Duke can't control the rain. And she says, because everything has to be symbolic, just because something is not perfect does not make it any less worthy of love. And the Duke is kind of like, ugh. Like, he kind of tries to stop her because he's like, I don't want to do this. And she's like, sorry, too late. It's begun. I'm doing it. And she tells him, you know, like, I love you. I'm tired of pretending that I don't love you. Every scar, every flaw, I love you. And it's like, really? 3 months? Okay. But she loves him. She's like, I'm tired of this. Right? Your thing with your children, your vow to your father who like is fucking dead. Like, whatever, dude. I love you. And I'm going to pick this. Like, I choose it. I'm choosing it now. I chose it before. I'm still choosing it. You decide. But like, I needed to tell you this because it was going to fucking eat me alive. And then she's kind of like,
and you need to choose for yourself, essentially.
Again, she's gotten soaked through in the rain and somehow doesn't die of pneumonia. So what are we to believe? 1800s.
It's the summertime. It's warm rain. Oh, it's a warm rain.
Anyway, yeah. She goes upstairs. I assume she dries off because her hair looks crazy. She's in a robe. He comes to her room and he's like, I mean, pretty much just like, yeah. I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to be a good husband or a good father, but I know I don't want to be alone. And I know that I want to be with you. And I love you and you're my wife. And they.
Does he say that?
Just like that. Like, in that tone of voice. felt too real. Had to get silly. And she's like, lit. You don't have to know how because we're going to do it together. Mm-hmm. And
we're going to choose this every day. And it's going to be hard. It's not going to be easy.
Justice for Lon Hammond. Justice for Prince Friedrich. Okay, you know who wouldn't have done her like this? Prince Friedrich. Anyway, so they fuck. Of course, that's what they're going to do. He doesn't pull out. It's a big deal. Wow. Ooh. Who would have thought, guys, at the beginning of Bridgerton, who would have thought how big a plot point jizz would have been in this story?
Hey, how romantic. Que romance.
Que romance. A little ejaculation. Girl, que romance.
And let me tell you. The transitions sometimes in this show kill me every time. I know
exactly what you're talking about. The disrespect.
Because as soon as he's done, right, they do it. He's made a decision that they can have a baby and grow their family by finishing.
I'm unable.
Lady Whistledown in voiceover says, is there to ever be a grander finish to a season than the one provided by the Duke and the Duchess?
The, even Paula, even when after Daphne Lika learns to masturbate and she's sitting at the piano, yes, and Lady Bridgerton is like, oh, you finished.
You finished.
How? Like, yeah. And I'm like, this is so disrespectful to us all.
It sends me every time.
God, it is very funny though. But yeah, so Daphne and the Duke, they fuck. Jizz, it's great. And we get that little Lady Whistledown voiceover. Grander finish to the season? Certainly not. And we go from this like joyous moment, finally our hero and heroine, they're together, to the sad news once the Featheringtons arrive home from the Hastings Ball, that Lord Featherington has bitten the fucking dust. My man made his last bet, okay? He's done. It's over. And I mean, Lady Featherington is like, what the fuck? Goes over to his desk, realizes that all of their money is gone. All of it is gone. All of it. And now she's grieving. She's not grieving that the man is dead. She's grieving the fact that now their security is super fucking precarious. Now everything is gone. What the fuck are they gonna do? So she doesn't even know who's meant to inherit their home, the Featherington home, because she's a woman, right? She's a woman and she has daughters. Only the next man in the Featherington line is going to inherit her home. And then what the fuck happens? Who the fuck is that? And what's he about? No one knows. So
who knows?
Yeah. And so we see Penelope with Eloise. Eloise is trying to comfort her. And she says the sweetest thing. I loved this part where she was like, I hope I can provide you a reason every day to like keep going even without your papa.
Aww, so it is good. Very sweet. It is very sweet. I season two really upset me when it comes between Penelope and Eloise. Rewatching this made me miss them because it's so sweet.
They have such a sweet friendship.
They do.
Because even though Eloise can be like kind of a baby, you can tell mm-hmm. that she cares so much about Penelope.
They do. They really care about each other and they look out for each other.
Yes.
Kind of ish.
One would hope. Yeah. And so I love that. Penelope is like, she's grieving. She's crying. Eloise is trying to comfort her. I feel like she's crying in equal parts about her father's death and Colin departing for Greece.
Mm-hmm. She looks out the window and Colin's outside getting ready to ride away.
He's outside just petting a horse. And you're like, oh, he's leaving because he's petting that horse.
Yes, that's the sign. universally.
You know, the whole family kind of gets together outside of the Bridgerton house to say farewell. Despedir. There's no better word than despedir, but to say
truly
fare thee well to Colin. And Daphne's there with the Duke of Hastings. They're chilling. Everything's cool, baby. It's all groovy.
They're doing it again, so they're happy.
They're super happy. And, you know, they chat a little bit with Antony. Antony and the Duke, who aren't quite, you know, they're not where they used to be, but they'll work on it, I'm sure, with whoever they recast as the Duke. He asks them, you know, oh, hey, what are your plans? Like, are you guys going back to Cliveden? And they're like, no, you know, we think we're going to stay in London a little bit longer because we like each other again and we're happy now.
Spend some time together because they can't do that in Cliveden, apparently. There's just too much staff.
Right? Like, Mrs. Coulson won't let us. Like, and Antony's like, gross, but good for you. Great. They kind of talk about him for a second where Daphne's like, well,
what are you going to do?
Yeah, what are your plans? What's your vibe? And he's like, you know, nothing much except finding the next Viscountess and or Viscountess and marrying her and declaring my intentions. And they're like, what?
Okay.
Right, because they're both kind of like, that's not what I asked, but that's great. And it's like, do you know who this woman is? And Antony's like, no, but it doesn't really matter because I've found the problem. And the problem is being in love. I need to find a woman that I can coexist with without loving her.
Love is only a distraction from the responsibilities.
Tato.
My guy, if you don't fucking get the fuck out of my face.
I'll punch you in the neck.
So, ya veremos. That's the setup for season two. And we're going to see how that plays out. Well, we have seen how that plays out. It's a very good season.
It is very
good. It played out very well.
We liked it. And before the season closes, in the last like 60 seconds of this fucking episode, we finally get the official glimpse into who the fuck Lady Whistledown is. Guess what, bitches? It's Penelope Featherington.
Penelope. Who would have thunk it?
Who would have fucking thought? damn.
Did you thunk it?
Did I thunk it? No, I genuinely did not know who the fuck Lady Whistledown was. After this shot of Penelope Featherington being fucking Lady Whistledown, holy shit, what a revelation.
Holy shit. I think I was surprised too.
I was very surprised. I was super caught off guard.
And it wasn't until the rewatch where I realized how obvious it was.
Yeah, it was obvious the whole time. No, you're right. You're right. After this revelation with Lady Whistledown, Penelope Featherington, we get a flash forward several months to Daphne and Simon as Daphne is in her bed giving birth.
On the same bed that his mom gave birth to him.
Oh, but this time, instead of like, this is the other thing too.
This time it's happy.
This time, instead of like a stormy night where everybody looks angry and everyone wants to know if it's a boy and like, and she's bleeding to death, his mother. Instead of that, it's like Daphne, her Lady Bridgerton is there holding one of her hands. The Duke is there holding the other hand. Everyone's happy and optimistic. And it's like, all right.
It's a bright, sunny day.
It's a bright, gorgeous day. Everything is so well lit. And it's like, just give another push and this baby's going to be out here.
And you're good.
Birth looks horrifying and I've never done it and I don't plan to. It looks absolutely terrible. And Daphne does whatever it is you have to do to get a baby out of your body. And they get the baby out and tell the Duke it's a boy. Much different scene than when the Duke was born at Cliveden.
It was. Daphne holds the baby. She passes the baby over to the Duke. Mm-hmm. Lady Bridgerton, who asked what will his name be?
Yes.
The Duke declares whatever it is going to start with an A.
We have family traditions, don't we?
Because we have family traditions. Oh, I love it.
Also, it makes me so annoyed that he doesn't come back for season two. I mean, of course, it's a job and you don't have to do shit you don't want to do when it comes to a job. But like, it's annoying because it's like now his character feels so nicely wrapped at the end of season one.
Well, he does. And maybe that's why they felt like we could wrap this story. We could keep it going.
Well, people reacted so strongly to him.
They really did.
That in season two, like the fact that his character, they have to like, I mean, this isn't much of a spoiler, but like his character doesn't return in season two because the actor himself chose not to return to the show. And it's just annoying because you like they have a great relationship and then you see Daphne alone a lot.
Yeah, like, oh, he's working
and it's
and
like
I'm visiting the family.
Is he working?
Yeah, no, it would have been really nice to see him come back. I think they wanted to continue to include them. Yes. In the rest of the stories, right? Because they you see the way Daphne influences Anthony's story.
Yes.
The Duke could have provided so much more of an influence as well in Anthony's story, right? Because they had such a conflict in this season.
Him not attending Anthony's wedding.
Right.
Unhinged. Like,
you know, so there's just, and they kind of just glaze over it. You're and obviously you're distracted by the love story you're watching.
Yeah.
But when you think of it, when you're thinking of this specific character and you're like, damn, it would have just been nice to see that rap and to see and continue to see their chemistry on screen and continue to see how
Daphne's happiness they help
Daphne's happiness and also how they continue to help like the other Bridgerton brothers come up.
And even Simon interacting with Kate would have been funny.
Yeah.
Because like get a load of this guy.
Yes. I feel like that would have been such a great dynamic. Yeah. You know, it's unfortunate that Reggae John Page decided not to be part of season two. I think it would have been a great addition, but season two was still amazing.
Yeah.
Like they did great. It's just when you think about it, so just based on his character, you're like, damn, that probably would have been awesome.
Yeah.
But it didn't need the Duke either.
Yeah.
You get what I mean? It would have been nice, but it also didn't need it.
It didn't. I mean, you didn't even necessarily need Daphne, but she's still part of it.
Well, she helps Anthony's character arc.
Sort himself out. Right.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, I mean, they could have easily had another sibling do that. Like they could have had Benedict do more of that or Colin even. Maybe. Like,
yeah, but I think it's significant because of how much he was involved
in her
season.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that they had Daphne again. It was frustrating again for the story because there were some parts where you know the Duke absolutely would have been there in person and it's weird that he wasn't.
Absolutely.
But he and Daphne are still supposed to have a good relationship and like they have now they have a child and like whatever.
You meet the baby.
Phoebe Dynevor isn't going to be in season three, but she left it open to being involved in future seasons, where she was
if she's invited is what she said.
Yes, yeah. Which I think she would be. I mean, can you imagine
I would hope so.
How much money they probably tried to throw at Reggae John Page to get him to be back for season two?
It wasn't enough
for that man to be like, nah, I'm straight. Like, yeah. So that brings us to the end of Bridgerton season motherfucking one.
Woo. This is the season that started it all, that created the fandom. Well, I should say that expanded the fandom beyond, I think, what Julia Quinn could have ever imagined.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Agree.
Also, did you know that the decision to reveal Whistledown who she was done after filming wrapped?
Can I tell you something where I'm going to say, okay, that makes a lot of sense now that you say it. Penelope's wig in that scene, not fucking it.
They couldn't get the same girl back. Like, we just need somebody real quick to put her wig on.
The skill that this production team has with costuming, wigs, makeup, like, it's the best of the fucking best are doing all of their styling, all of their like hair design, yeah. Like, they're so fucking good. And the fact that Penelope's wig line in that extra little bonus scene that I'm sure they shot like 6 months later is like not it. It's just like it was fast. Like, someone please. Because there's like a little teeny tiny gap. Like a teeny teeny tiny gap.
Oh, no.
Where you could see her, because she's a blonde in real life, but you can tell that it's just not lining up right.
Oh wow, you were looking real close.
Because it bothered me, Paola. I always notice wigs, and Ryan doesn't really.
There was some points where Daphne's wig was bothering me. I'm like, yes, come on, they could have smoothed that out a little bit.
Also, her hair color confuses me.
But overall, no. Overall, the whole makeup team and costuming in this series is spectacular.
Absolutely.
Spectacular. Mm-hmm. All right. Let's wrap this up. Any final thoughts? Those were it, I think.
I ended season one and I loved it, and I was hyped for season two, and then I loved season two even more. Again, yes. I've mentioned this, like, Colin and Penelope are not like my peeps. They're not my, you know, one true pairing, but cool. I'm excited to see the show.
I want to see them together, especially on the rewatch. I'm like, oh my God, we've been watching this just simmer.
Oh Lord.
It's just been on low for like two seasons, and like, I'm ready for the boil over.
I'm more ready for Penelope to like step into her power.
Oh, I cannot wait. And we don't know if they're going to reveal that she's whistled down in season three.
Yeah,
they can continue to keep that
a secret.
We don't know if they're gonna reveal that, because I don't know what revealing that does to the rest of the characters and their stories. So we will see. So yeah, no. So at this point, Bridgerton is killing it. I mean, after its success with season one, its success with season two, we are seeing all types of branding partnerships. They have a Ruggable line, and Bath and Body Works has a new Bridgerton line of scents and lotions and, you know, all their things with specific scents.
Dude, and we've talked about all of this without mentioning that Paola and I took our mom to the Bridgerton Experience Ball.
Oh my God, we did.
In New York City, and had a great motherfucking time.
Hell yeah.
That shit was fire.
Last May for Mother's Day, the Bridgerton Experience came to New York, and we took ourselves and mom to the Bridgerton Experience, and you get to see like a dramatization of Queen Charlotte and coming out, and like kind of like you're at a debutante ball, and she picks the diamond and you do the dances. It is very fun. And if you love Bridgerton and you love the Bridgerton world and they're doing the Bridgerton Experience by you, I would definitely recommend it. It was a very cool experience. It was very nice. It was a good time. Like,
I loved it.
Go have some drinks and dance a little and get dressed up. It was awesome.
All right, sister, book or show?
Show.
Yeah, honestly, like it's not even a fucking question. Sorry, Julia Quinn. Thank you for creating this universe.
Absolutely. Thank you, Julia Quinn, for the books.
Yeah.
Thank you, Shonda Rhimes, for the idea of making this shit into a show, because it got me.
And thank you for expanding the Bridgerton cinematic universe.
Hell yes. Yeah, yes. So show 100%.
Will your husband watch this with you?
He won't admit to watching this with me. He probably won't accept an invitation to watch this with me. However, if it's on and I'm watching it, he will start asking questions, to which I will shoo him away. Leave me alone. I can't do this with you. If you want to watch, sit and watch. But no, he won't admittedly come and sit and watch with me.
Yep, yep. My husband will watch this with me, shockingly. Not at first, but now he will, yes.
Eventually, yes. They will eventually fall.
They'll come around.
For sure.
They'll come around.
They will come around because it's just the hot goss.
It is. It is the hot goss. It's the hot goss. God, it's the hot goss. It's the Duke. Come on. Ooh. On a scale of 1 to ardently admire and love, how do you feel about this show?
I think I ardently admire and love it.
It's like a solid 9 for me.
Yeah, no, I can watch this for a long time.
And she did. And she has. And she will.
And I have. Yeah, and I will. Yeah, I think I ardently admire and love it. Like, I'm so excited for season 3. I really enjoyed season 1. I could not stop talking about it. I really enjoyed season 2. Anthony wasn't even my guy, and they brought the heat. Oh my God, the line, the writing, the declarations in season 2. Melt. I love Bridgerton as a series.
Oh yeah, she's like a 9, 9.5 for me. One of my favorite TV shows I probably have ever seen.
Like, I will stop what I'm doing to watch. Like, the new season, I remember I had no time to watch Queen Charlotte when it came out.
Oh my God, I know.
Like, I was so busy. It was out for like a week and I still wasn't able to watch it. And I was like, you know what? Fuck life. I'm going to stay up for, how long is
it? 6 episodes.
7 hours. Mm. Okay. And I did. I just binged it in a night. And that's what I had to do to be able to get through, to be able to fit it into my life. And I made the sacrifice and it was worth it.
Queen Charlotte was so good.
Generational trauma. Oh, they love hitting. They love bringing in some generational trauma. I mean, you're dealing with a big old family. Mm-hmm. You're dealing with the patriarchal society. Mm-hmm. You're dealing with a lot of restraint and rules. There's trauma everywhere. It's what drives the main characters all of the time.
Yeah.
So in this particular season, obviously our main traumas are the Duke's relationship with his father.
For sure.
And the expectations put onto women in this society.
1000%.
And that's definitely something that continues to carry through. The illusion of perfection, I think, is something, misinformation about women's bodies and married life. Mm-hmm. And do they stay together?
Duh.
Yeah, they do. I mean, we don't see them again in season 2, but they stay together.
From what we hear, they stay together.
They do stay together.
All right, sister.
That's all right. On season 1 of Bridgerton, meet us back here in about a week or two. Mm-hmm. So we can talk about season 2, baby.
Woo, woo, woo.
Burr, 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 burr.
Yeah. And
thank you for kicking off our Springer 10 as we get ready for Bridgerton season 3. Burr, 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 burr. Coming out soon. Sooner than you think. We're already in April. It's coming out in May. A month away, baby.
So exciting.
This is my Mother's Day gift.
From the universe.
I want a day where everyone
leaves you alone,
pretends I'm not a mother, and lets me watch Bridgerton from beginning to end.
I feel like that's what every mother wants.
So thank you for joining us on the kickoff of our Springerton as we get ready for Bridgerton season 3 dropping in May. Join us back here in a couple of weeks, a week or two.
Yep.
When we recap season 2. And get into one of like the slowest, yummiest burns that I've gotten from a period show. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for listening. If you like what you heard and you want to hear more, leave a review. Come and find us on Instagram, SisWix Podcast. Shoot us an email at siswixpodcast@gmail.com and let us know what you think. If you have suggestions or movie requests for us to cover in the future.
Ooh, ooh. Thanks, everyone.